I want to explain to start with how I settle on the great book of Job for our subject matter for these next 3 months or so. For one thing, in our study of the book of James, we came to the place in James chapter 5 where James said, you remember, you've heard of the patience of Job. And James believed, obviously, that Christians should be able to call to their minds the experience of Job, and that that would help to sustain them in seasons of agony in their lives. So that would be, I think, if I were listing them like this, that would be one of the things that I would say is James on Job makes it important for us to make this story fresh in our minds. And as I've thought about James's word on this, I notice again the tie between his statement in James 5 and his statement that he started with in James 1, verse 2 or so, where he talked to us about regarding it as joy when we fall into trials of different kinds, because these trials can produce patience in our lives. That's one of the things. The second thing that I've noticed is that I've been asked recently several times questions that show that people have this matter on their mind. I could think of at least four occasions as I was working on this, some here who have asked me this, and my answers on this matter certainly have their limitations. I think about everybody's do. I want to tell you something that happened just last week, and Nancy won't mind me telling you this, but I thought it was a humorous reflection on my answer. She stopped and asked me a very personal question about working through grief, and how does a person get over this? And I had to tell her, I'm not sure anybody ever does get over it. People just seem to learn to live with it. And I said, I wish I had a better answer. Nancy looked at me and in her unique way said, well, you did the best you could. So that's pretty much the story on any answer I can give to questions like that. I can do my best. But the encouragement part of it, to me at least, is I think that's all anybody can do. I've never heard an answer that covers every base on a theme like this, and I doubt that there are any. So I think we probably need to be aware of that, and we'll talk some in this series about how do we talk to people who are in the furnace of affliction, and we try to do that. And the other thing that I find is simply that this book of Job is something that really, to me, captures our attention and imagination like a few other parts of the Bible can. And I noticed I've collected over the years things that I've found written about this book. And one of my favorites is a chapter from some fellow's book, where he wrote about Job, and he had the chapter titled, Job, A Graduate Degree in Suffering. And I think that describes the message of this book in a limited way, not completely, but in a limited way. I thought it might be helpful if we kind of get started with this study by asking ourselves some questions, and I'm hoping you can participate without it being too uncomfortable for you. And if you can, do so. First question is, why in your mind does the suffering of a man like Job raise questions? And let me tell you what I mean by a man like Job from the book itself. It says that Job, that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. Now, given the kind of man he was, what does the suffering of a man like that, what question does that raise in your mind?
It makes me think of the debate we watched, the atheist, and, you know, he was saying, if there was a God of love, he couldn't allow things like that to happen.
All right. What Brenda said tells you that this realm has always been one of the first handles that unbelief grabs hold of to fight against faith. I remember my favorite, I thought, the professor that I had in college who had the most depth about him told us in class one day on some other subject that to him, the problem of evil, the problem of pain, was the biggest challenge to faith there was, more than any scientific or historical matter, this problem. Can you think, what other questions? If there's a good God, why does this happen, in other words? Anybody else, can you tell me what questions this raises in your mind?
What good does it do to be good? All right. It's going to happen to you anyway.
Well said. What good does it do to be good, then? Anybody else? Gene?
How come I'm suffering my neighbor's not?
All right. Why am I, here I am trying to go to church and trying to fill my place in the Lord's service and trying to know Him from His Word, and here my neighbor over here is ignoring all of that. He seems to be healthy, wealthy, and happy. And that's a big question, and that's a biblical question, too. Both Jeremiah and Habakkuk deal with that in the Bible. Anything else?
What did I do to deserve
this? All right, what did I do to deserve it? That assumes that I did something that brought this about, and if I had not, it wouldn't have happened like this to me. Anybody else?
Everyone deserving when times are really bad.
All right. If this happens to Job and everybody left him, then what are they going to do to me when I get in some situation like that? His friends came and sat around with him a week and argued with him. Will anybody even show up when it happens to me? You know, that type of question. Anybody else?
I keep hearing the kids saying, that's not fair.
All right, it's not fair. I heard Kay tell ours, a lot of things aren't fair.
Yeah.
His sister has said,
all right. There's where it gets the questions that we're talking about that are dealt with in the book of Job have raised a whole... whole field of reasoning, and you'll find it with this word here. The study of the justice of God, trying to justify God's actions and His work and providence to say that He is righteous in His rule of the world. Let me get a little more personal. If you don't feel comfortable answering this, don't. When in your life so far have you struggled with similar thoughts?
Today.
All right. We brought some of them up in this class, didn't we? Today, and with the current difficulties that people go. You listen to our prayer list, and you see some of that. Anybody else?
Well, I'm thinking about it in a little different way because...
No, you have to think about it.
Okay. So only that thing happened in our family over the last year, and I've kind of thought, why am I not having to go through it? Why is it someone else?
That's a very, very, yeah, a very important part of this is This happens a lot in our culture, in our society, and it drives a lot of times even public and political discussions. The feeling of guilt that this happened to somebody else and not me. That's a surprising way in which this shows up. And it does a lot more than you think. One of the elements in every grief I have observed is sooner or later the surviving person feels guilty that it wasn't him or her. Strange thing. Anybody else?
The whole situation with Casey. All right. What did we do wrong?
All right. The what happens with parents who tried to help a young one? Yeah. Didn't work out, maybe. Xander?
I was going to say there was a time or two when Kathy was in the hospital.
Yeah.
I questioned that because she was, I don't tell you, but she's so small.
Yeah. Yeah, the, she is. Right, the innocent suffering of a little. Anybody else? I'm not encouraging you too much so far, am I? What we're dealing with is life. I can name times in my own journey where those feelings have certainly been there, and they've been hard to make heads or tails out of. What kinds of, let's get a little more, not quite as heavy here, but just to reflect on it, what kinds of answers have you heard suggested for the questions and problems we've mentioned so far? My point with this is that sometimes we answer things where we don't know what we're talking about, and sometimes intended help only makes it worse. So what kind of answer? Some of these may be good, strong answers. What kind of answer? If they've helped you or if they haven't?
No, not really. Everybody just hits it. You can't question God.
All right, we've heard that you can't, and that leave out a significant portion of Job, by the way.
I read a pamphlet from
Hannibal
one time, that suffering is almost all suffering is the result of sin. It's not your sin, maybe, but sin has happened somewhere that has caused the suffering down the line.
Oh, just the fact that we live in a world where sin has entered and existed raises the complications along that line in so many ways. What other answers?
It's God's will.
All right, that's been the one that I've heard. I remember when I was in my 20s, and I can remember that part. We had one of the deacons in the congregation at home, businessman, two teenage kids, the treasurer for the congregation, who was driving home from Harrison, Arkansas, and a truck hit him on a bridge, and I got a call and had to go to that family's house, and one of the other church members walked in and said to them, "It's just God's will." And that can hit like a ton of bricks, can it? Yeah. Anybody else? John?
I know that I didn't find this very helpful at the time, but Kathy was sick. They didn't say, God will give you more than you can handle.
Yeah, a questionable application of 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, yeah. Anybody else? I'm so far nobody has quoted me, and I'm glad for that. Okay, Casey first.
Well, Perry's doing a lot of the preacher said, I have to defend my God because everybody keeps saying, why did God let this happen? And I have to point out that God didn't do this for the whole purpose.
Yeah.
So it's not that God is doing horrible things to us.
Okay.
That goes back, I guess, to it all leads back to sin.
Okay.
Our neighbor had children out of wedlock, and they were very faithful in their faith, and so it was very difficult for him and his wife. But he had an interesting perspective. Some people said, why did this happen? And he said, perspective was, why not me? Instead of why me, why not me?
Why not me? It happens to people. Why shouldn't it happen?
And he knew he was strong enough in his faith to handle it, even though it wasn't comfortable. Yeah. But why not him?
Yeah. Anybody else with some explanation that you've heard over the years? Not necessarily to you, but to somebody else, Larry?
One explanation was given to one person. The closer you're getting to God, the more Satan wants you, and Satan is sifting you, just as he sifted Peter, who would have had his chance.
And he certainly did with Job here, didn't he? Job turned out to be a candidate for this because he was close to God, like Larry said. All right, let's take the time before it all gets away from us to briefly introduce to ourselves the book of Job. We'll get acquainted with it a little bit this week, and then next week journey into the text a little bit more. And the things you guys have said so far and the emotion that I'm already seeing on our faces tells me that we're dealing with something like it always has been that's a power to it. Here's the way I would summarize this. First, the book of Job is a unique book and a uniquely valuable book of the Bible. It's classified as wisdom literature. And the book of Jeremiah, I think Jeremiah 18 and verse 18, if I recall, shows that there were priests and prophets, but also sages, some of the versions will call them, or wise men. And the priests and the prophets would declare or proclaim God's word to the people. The wise men would offer their wisdom on how it applied and how life worked generally. And they would deal with the problem areas, the philosophical, the what does life mean type questions. And this book fits along with the Psalms and the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. It's being classified in the New Testament as the writings. There'd be the law and the prophets and the writings. And these writings would be what I sometimes call wisdom literature. This book and its subject matter is unique, certainly, because it deals with one man's struggle with his suffering, and no other part of the Bible does it in quite the same way. Then there's the literary form. Job has a sandwich, a big sandwich type of an arrangement. Chapters 1 and 2 are written in historical narrative form. And the last part of chapter 42 is written in historical narrative form. And all the chapters in between are written not only in poetic form, but in a poetic form which is a conversation back and forth. And it is everybody regards it as one of the masterpieces of all times. And I would say, in its form, certainly the most amazing that I'm acquainted with at all. Secondly, there are to Job some unknowns that are important to bear in mind. For example, we don't know exactly when this book was written. Everything about Job as a person suggests that he lives maybe around the time of Abraham. Some think even before Abraham, and I'll just mention to you the reasons for that. First, the length of his life is long, and it fits with the time of the patriarchs. Second, his wealth is measured not in gold or silver, but in the how many head of livestock he had. That fits with patriarchal times. Thirdly, he is a non-Israelite. Job is from the area east of the Dead Sea and a little south of the Dead Sea. And he is not a descendant of of Jacob or of Israel, suggesting that maybe he predated that. That would have been the time of the patriarchs. And then he serves as the priest for his own family. He's the one who seems to offer the sacrifices for his own family, suggesting again that he lived in the time of the patriarchs, when God had, when God dealt with man through the heads of the families, patriarchs, and rule over them that way. Now, the thing is, Job, we don't know for sure that Job is the author of the book about himself. That is the doubtful thing. We don't know exactly when the book was written. Some people believe that it, like the other wisdom literature, is written about the time of Solomon. I'll get it right in what I say in a minute. About the time of Solomon. I don't know that that makes a whole lot of difference, but it is an interesting thing. It's interesting to notice that the name of God, the Lord, occurs several times in the first two chapters and then in the last part of chapter 42, but only one time in the rest of the book, chapter 12 and verse 19. And that's just a kind of an interesting thing about this. So I like the way somebody said it. We don't know the writer, but we do know the author, meaning that it's inspired, an inspired piece, and one of the ways in which God has made himself known. I think it's important to observe that this is the record of a real person and real events. And I say that because James mentions Job as if he were a historical person, doesn't he? In James chapter 5, for you've heard of the patience of Job, it says. And then in Ezekiel 14, twice, Ezekiel mentions three characters together, and is it Moses and Daniel and Job? Job is one of them. Let me make sure I'm telling you the truth about this. Ezekiel 14, I believe. At verse 14, it's Noah. Boy, am I glad I looked it up. Noah, Daniel, and Job. If they, even if they had been there, God wouldn't have blessed Israel in their sins. So I say that to say that Job is treated as a real person and an outstanding example of godliness in a real person's life. And that's interesting to remember, too. The fourth thing that helps us to introduce is to have a general working knowledge of the story or the event in this book. And I think most everybody in this room has some knowledge of the story that takes place in this great book of the Bible. But just briefly, remember that suffering comes to Job, unimaginable suffering comes to Job as a result, really, of God's confidence in Job. That's the crucial thing. This, unbeknownst to Job, he doesn't have the benefit, he never gets the benefit in this story of what takes place in the first chapter and in the second chapter that led to what happened to him. And neither he nor his friends nor his wife know why this all happens to him. It is provoked by the work of an adversary, translated as Satan, but that's what the name means. And this adversary is not as much interested in Job's suffering as he is in trying to prove that no human being would ever worship or be loyal to the God of heaven if it weren't for the blessings that God could provide. That may seem to you like it makes perfect sense until you think that God seeks a relationship with creatures made in His own image. If I were to say, Casey would never, ever sit here that close to Becky unless she wanted Grandma to take care of the boys once in a while. That would be somewhat... That wasn't too far off. But, you can see, if you think about this now, you can see what an insult and how low an opinion of the relationship that would be. And if you think, well, God was out of place in allowing this, and you have to realize that what is at stake here is the value of a relationship between God and man. Is it so shallow as being pretty much like a fee of prostitution? Is God of no higher standing than a pimp? That is the slander that the devil brings here. Is it possible for our hearts to be drawn to God because of who He is, and for us to love Him enough that we will seek to draw near to Him no matter what? Or is the adversary's accusation true? Is man so low that everything is for sale? And is God so pitiful that He can't receive any love unless he buys it? There used to be some old country song, and I can remember the face of the old boy that I saw on PBS doing the song. He had a song. There's only two things money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. That's a pretty low opinion of man. Is it true in relation to God and His search for our hearts? That's what the story in this book is about. Now, remember the story. What happens is the accusation by the adversary is made before God. God's proof that that's not so is one man, and that man is Job. The adversary says, remember, well, Job may be doing all that, but it's because you're paying him off. If you took his check away every month, he'd curse you to your face quicker than you could turn your head. And so, the adversary, who has only limited power and he can't do beyond what he's allowed to do, is in this book allowed to reach out and touch Job as long as he doesn't take his life. Well, first, as long as he doesn't touch his flesh, and then as long as he doesn't take his life. And Job loses all that. And then the adversary works on Job psychologically. The idea is that Job, or any human being, can sustain loss and grief as long as he can have confidence in that God will be with him and help him through it. But in Job, what the adversary does is to seek to destroy that confidence in God, so that Job is left without his theological framework for life, so to speak. So what happens is, first, Job loses his wife's support. Then Job loses his friend's support. And then his friends attack Job's relationship with God, suggesting that he has brought this on himself. And Job cannot understand. Job knows that none of what they're saying is true in his case, but he can't figure out where God is while he's going through all this. And that's why the story touches us like it does, because it's not as much about what particular problem you have as it is about where God is and what you do when your assumptions and the things that you've believed about how life ought to work don't seem to be playing out. So there, what happens when experience challenges your faith? That's the issue. And that leads us to the theme of the book. And I say this a little different than most people. I don't think the theme of this book is just why do the righteous suffer and why is evil not punished. I think the theme of this book is whether a man or a woman will serve God for nothing. Is it possible for a human being to serve God just because he's God? I think that's what the book of Job is about. And you may have a little bit different view of it, but at least bear that possibility in mind as we go along. What kind of God rules this world? And that's the issue that's at stake here as we go through this book. I brought with me a poem that I found somewhere, and I've been around long enough for a lot of this to be true. I'm going to adapt it just a little bit. It fits one of the questions I asked you a while ago. Listen to this. I'm not trying to break hearts, but I want you to feel what's at stake here. I've sat beside a tiny crib and watched the baby die. His parents slowly turned towards me to ask, "Oh, brother, why?" I've held the youthful husband's head and felt death's even sigh. The widow looked through tears and said, "Dear preacher, tell me why." I've heard the white-tipped tapping cane which leads the blinded eye, and then a dark and lonely voice cries, "Brother, show me why." I've caught a fiancée's burning tears and heard her lonely cry. She had an unused wedding gown and shouted, "Preacher, why?" I've heard the cancer patient say, "'Tis gain for me to die," then look into his daughter's face and mutely whisper, "Why?" I've seen a father take his life, a widow stand nearby. His little children say, "Dear Mom, will the preacher tell us why?" I've heard an orphan faintly say, who gazed into the sky, "My mom and dad have gone away. My preacher will know why." I've tiptoed to my father's throne, so timid and so shy, to say, "Dear God, some of your own are wanting to know why." That's the experience of Job. And I did hear the bell. Remember, you owe me 3 minutes. let's look at this. The message of this book is not tied up in as neat a package as we wish it were. The message of the book is, since a person can't always understand what happens to him, and much less the reason behind it all, let him humble himself before God and trust the Almighty to see him through. Boy, that's easy to say, easy to read, and awfully hard to apply. But Job ends up doing it. Now, not even Job can do it without having to lay his hand over his mouth at the end and say, I've spoken about some things that were too wonderful for me, meaning past my finding out. And then the purpose of the book. I have several maybe great lessons from it too, but the purpose of it is, it seems to me, to strengthen man by justifying the wisdom and goodness of God in matters of human suffering. And listen to this, and to show that not everything that happens in life happens because God desires it or because it's fair. In other words, the purpose of this book is to show that we ought to be careful about assuming that we can always answer what happens in people's lives. Our answers may be generally true and sometimes true, but no human being can provide an answer to human grief that is always true. And Job's friends came and said some things to him that were sometimes true, but not one of them said things that applied to Job. That's the point. All right, here's some of the great lessons that we'll gain from this book, and I have two-thirds of this lesson still to go. But this book will tell us, first, that there may be some things happening in God's providence that we don't know about. There may be something at stake that we're not in a position to see. It will show that it's possible to be good and godly and right, even when you're discouraged and complaining. This book will show Job complains and God never condemns him for it. It will show that patience is steadfastness and not passiveness. Oh, Job, fight this battle not like a lump on a log. But have you guys ever seen the picture of the frog who grabs trying to grab the fly or the bug, whatever it is, and the bug has hold of the old frog's neck like that? That's how Job is in this book. He goes down battling, and his patience is there. And then God is so great. Listen, this is so meaningful. God is so great that no answer is necessary. We want it, but the message of Job is that God is greater than that. And then, significantly, this book says that there is a blank in the human heart which only Christ can fill. And I want to end by showing you a statement that I think may prove my point. Job 19, 25 and 26, amidst one of his calls for judgment. Just listen to this. For I know that my Redeemer lives. How often have we sung? Do you know where that came from? I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last, he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, and the translation difficulty will be here, does it mean without or in my flesh? English Standard says, yet in my flesh I shall see God. Now that couldn't be true without Christ. And Job will also ask for an umpire, a mediator, to stand between him and God. Christ is the answer to that. All right, that briefly introduces what we'll be talking about. Please read chapters 1, 2, and 3 for next week. All right, 1, 2, and 3. Thanks for being with us today.